My word.
A panel game devised by Tony Shrine and Edward J. Mason. And here to introduce the teams is Michael O'Donnell.
Thank you very much, and welcome to another exhibition of verbal calisthenics performed by our teams of outstanding calisthenical competitors, Frank Muir and Dilys Powell. And Dennis Norton and Antonia Fraser. And their first exercise, as always, is a matter of definition. Frank, what's the meaning of izzard? I-double-Z-A-R-D.
It's a lizard that's passed its driving license.
In fact, it's a now obsolete name for for the
how
letter.
Dare you ask me obsolete terms?
Well, you're rather good on them, usually. Obsolete name for the letter Z, or Z.
Is it?
Antonia, what's the meaning of postulant? P-O-S-T-U-L-A-N-T.
Oh, well, as a former convent girl, that is one, though not as a former nun, that is one word. I mean, in a convent, it means someone who is seeking to become a nun. And I suppose the strict meaning of it is seeking something, isn't it?
Yes, that'll win you 2 marks. Well done. It's one who asks or petitions for something, a candidate, especially a candidate for admission to a religious order. 2 marks, I tell you. Dilys, the meaning of cerebellum. C-E-R-E-B-E-L-L-U-M.
It's to do with the mind or the brain.
Yes, it is to do with the brain, than the mind, probably.
It's a bit of the brain.
It is, in fact, the bit of the brain that's largely concerned with balance and your sense of where you are in space. Dennis, the meaning of nexus, N-E-X-U-S.
That's one of those words I've only got to see it, and I stop reading. It's the rest of it. It's a giveaway word, actually, because you generally read about the socio-economic nexus or the military-industrial nexus, and it shows it's written by the man, sort of man who would use that sort of language. I don't know what it's a kind of tie-up between two things.
An interface.
An ongoing relationship, in fact, it is by the same man. But you've got your 2 marks because it's a bond or link or interconnected group. So we give you 2 marks. Now, before we go on to round two, here, Frank and Dennis, are the quotations you're given for the last round. And Frank's is, oh dear, what can the matter be? And Dennis, every little movement has a meaning of its own. From the 1910 Broadway musical, Madame Sherry. Meanwhile, a roundup, Peter Moore says, of horses. Frank, an autobiography was published in 1877 which purported to be written by a horse. What was its title?
By a horse? Ad hoc. Yes. Now, it's not National Velvet.
No, it's the other one.
It's the other one. It's Black Beauty and a Sewell.
Well done. 2 marks, Frank.
I was waiting for a joke. the horse also rode Eric or Bit by Bit.
St. Winnie Freeds or the World of
School. Antonia, your question calls on your considerable knowledge of science and engineering. What in mechanical terms is the definition of one horsepower?
I knew you were going to ask me that question.
It's expressed in the... it's the power needed to raise a certain poundage, 1 foot in 1 second. Just give me the number of pounds that a horse raises 1 foot in 1 second and you get...
I will. Don't let's hurry it.
That's much better than pounds, actually, is pence. If you put... If you have 10 pence, you put it in a phone box, you get the AA, they raise 10 pounds. Very quickly.
Well, it's not 551 pounds, and it's not 549 pounds. It lies somewhere between those limits.
Well, only a fool would guess 550 pounds, but
A fool is right, and many a fool wins 2 marks, and you win 2 marks.
Thank you very much. Isn't our chairman lovely? Who will disagree?
Dillis, what was unique about a horse by the name of either Incitatus or Incitatus, depending on whether it was Father McAvoy or Father Ray who was teaching me at the time. Anyway, it's Incitatus.
A-T which?
U-S.
U-N. Incitatus. Oh, it's a classical horse.
Yes.
Ah, there were a lot of famous horses there.
This one got rather favoured treatment.
Was it the one...
Because he's his owner.
Ah.
Was it made of...
yes, it was made an emperor or a god or something.
Well, not quite.
It was elevated.
Yes, elevated. Made a priest and a consul.
Consul.
Yes. Mm. Oh, dear, whose horse? Caligula's horse.
That's right. That'll get you 2 marks.
Caligula's horse. Mm.
Fed from an ivory manger and drank wine from a golden pail. Lucky horse. Well done. 2 marks to do. Dennis, King Richard III, Act 5, Scene 4. Alarums and excursions without, enter the king. He says...
a horse, my kingdom for a horse.
And I say 2 marks, Dennis.
By golly, he won through there.
A round of inscriptions. Frank, the Latin words meaning by perseverance I conquer is embossed upon a certain article to be found in many a bathroom.
It's our downstairs loo. You've got to pull the handle very slowly through 30 degrees, release it, and then push it very swiftly as far as it'll go. And if people get that sequence slightly out of order, it doesn't work. So it's by perseverance, you've got to keep at it, and we put under this, not in Latin, but in English, by perseverance, I conquer.
That's 2 marks. 2 marks. and of course, you got the label off a bar of coal tar soap, didn't you, to stick on under that? Because that's where, it is actually on the label of a well-known brand of coal tar soap.
I don't know who we're kidding. There is only one well-known.
Antonia, a little romantic tale for you. Sir Walter Raleigh is said to have scratched the following line upon a window pane. Fain would I climb, yet fear I to fall. Subsequently, Queen Elizabeth I is said to have scratched another line beneath it. Can you remember what line she scratched beneath it?
It's something like, those who fear too much do not climb at all.
That's getting, yes, it is. That you've really brought it into the modern vernacular.
That's what I was trying to do.
Yes.
It's really my mission.
Yes.
You know?
Yes. Well, I think you succeeded admirably. I mean, she scratched, if thy heart fails thee, climb not at all.
That's so old-fashioned these days,
yes.
I think.
Yes, it sort of has an Elizabethan touch to it.
It's really sort of faintly interesting, the Elizabethan graffiti, which in fact lasted a couple of hundred years of scratching graffiti on glass with a diamond. It lasted right down until the end of the 17th century, at least.
Dillis, where was written, though in a foreign language, the words which, when translated, read, "Abandon hope, all ye that enter here"?
It's the BBC.
Still there.
It's somewhere in Venice. It's in Venice. Isn't it?
According to Dante, it was over the gates of hell in the Inferno. Dennis, We're going to draw on your biblical knowledge here again. Part of the 14th verse of the 14th chapter of the book of Deuteronomy is printed or embossed upon a tin of a well-known brand of golden syrup. What is the quotation?
Well, it's something out of sweet. The word sweetness comes in. Out of sweetness cometh forth strength, was it?
The other way around. Try it the other way around.
Out of strength cometh forth sweetness.
That'll do for two marks, yes. It in fact says, out of the strong came forth sweetness, and that actually illustrates, or is illustrated by a drawing. It's in fact, officially, a picture of bees swarming over the abdomen of a dead lion.
Yes.
Which is an interesting way to sell golden syrup. A round of three-word quotations. Can you quote the line or lines of poetry that contain the following sequence of words? Frank, all our yesterdays.
Oh, yes, it was a television programme. And it was a story about the First World War by H.M. Tomlinson, which I never read, but pops up, has a very vigorous life in out-of-print catalogues. And it's Macbeth.
Yes.
It's a marvellous title for a book about the First World War, which Tomlinson's was, if I can remember. It's when Macbeth is told that his queen has dropped off the twig.
That's right. The queen, and my lord, is dead.
But it's all our yesterdays have lighted falls the path to dusty death.
That, the way
out,
to dusty
death. Out, brief candle.
Antonia, the silent dust.
Oh, it's going to be Jolly Old Grey, isn't
it? Yes, Jolly Old Grey.
Not for the first time on this programme, to be frank. It's something about smelling sweeter and all of that.
It's in the stanza that starts, can storied urn or animated bust back to its mansion call the fleeting breath continue? Can honour's voice provoke
the silent dust?
Well done, two marks.
I couldn't have managed that, did I?
Or flattery soothe the dull, cold ear of death. We'll give you two marks for that. Well
it's
done.
One of the less memorable bits, actually.
It is. That's why it's in this programme.
I know.
But we generally have the memorable bits.
Yes,
that's what's so unfair.
What happened to the ploughman plodding?
Right.
Dillis, triumph and disaster.
Oh, that's Kipling.
Yes.
Yes, and treat those two impostors just the same. It's out of if.
Well done. If. Two marks for Dillis. Dennis, a ghostly batsman. Where does those?
This is what cricketers get maudlin about. It's oh my Hornby and my Barlow long ago, and it's the run stealers flickering to and fro. And
can you remember the poet?
It's Francis Thompson, isn't it? Mm. Yeah.
Well done. Yes, we'll give you your two marks. It's a very short poem, in fact.
It's actually rather moving. I think it's one of the good bad poems.
The Hornby and Barlow in this. For years I thought the Hornby was the train.
Yeah.
Because it was one of our by heart. It's good. Anyway, Dennis got two well-earned marks there for tracking that down. We now come to Frank's quotation, oh dear, what can the matter be?
I was singing this the other day. Oh dear, what can the matter be? My wife's birthday's next Saturday. It's that awful problem of buying birthday presents for your dear lady. You know, normally, she doesn't like to have elaborate things. I usually give her something for the house that we both can share, like half a pound of pipe tobacco or a couple of pink ties. But this year, I really thought, no, next Saturday I must give her something much more interesting. And her one interest, her big interest, is the garden. I thought, I could buy her some things from the garden. And she's a very practical girl, so it's not a dozen roses or something, which I get all wrong and plant upside down or something. I'd get her some practical things. So I found in the local paper a thing called a car boot sale. And I thought I've special boots to wear in the car. It's got the, might be an idea. I went along, and it's not that at all. It's a lot of strange-looking chaps with a car boot open, selling a lot of things, like a white elephant stall. There weren't any white elephants there, because, you know, car boots. And the first thing I bought, I mean, I looked around, there's a strange lot of thrown-out stuff, and I thought, some of this must be useful. And then I bought, the first thing I bought my wife was a little picture. It's a lovely little picture, about 8 inches by 6. And it showed a chap in uniform, in the hot sun, with sitting in front of a tent. And he was at a table, and he was writing and looking at a photograph of a girl. And his tunic neck was undone. And the wording is all a bit stained, actually, the picture. But I managed to see the wording on the left. It said, "A pause in the Matabele War." And on the right, there were more wording, and it said, "Purveyors of soap to Her Majesty Queen Alexandra." So I bought this, because I thought that'll be marvellous for the garden, because my wife's greenhouse is too small. And I thought, if we throw away the picture of the Matabele War, she'll then have a piece of glass, 8 inches by 6, which would surely be just the thing for forcing mustard and cress. So I bought that, and I moved on, and there was, she's always complaining about the buckets and things aren't big enough nowadays, little plastic buckets, for carrying water around the garden to water the faraway stuff. And there was there, in this chap's car boot, one of those old Victorian hot water cans, you know, the flip-flop lid. They were galvanized, and a very short but very fat spout, and which held 4 gallons of water, the chap told me. So I bought it. I hadn't got a handle, but I got it for only 20p, which I thought was very reasonable. So I had this thing for holding water, and then the lust of buying then crept into me, and I couldn't stop there. And the chap said he had some wonderful fertilizer. And it was a very strange, old-looking sack, small sack. And it said, "Wonder DR compound, the horticulturalist's Vade Mecum." And I said, "What's that?" He said, "Well, it's DR, it's dung revivified." And on the back, it said that they got this new process of getting dung from the home counties, from the gentry, and they revivified it with dried seaweed and magnetism. And I thought that'd be marvellous. Unfortunately, there's a hole in the sack, and there's only about a teaspoonful left. But I got that for 15p. So I had the RD revivifier, as well as the hot water can, and the picture of the Matabele War, which I was going to throw away and keep the glass. But then a chap suddenly, I said to a chap there who had a whole lot of stuff in his car, "Have you got a swan-necked hoe?" Now, you know, you can't get swan-necked hoes now. They've disappeared. You know, they're the one with a wonderful little bit of iron which curves away in the shape of a swan's neck, and the blade which sort of points towards the operator on the end of a long handle. And I said, "Have you?" He said, "Of course we have, Gov. Of course I've got a swan-necked hoe." And in fact, he said, words he said, actually, he said it very loudly, as though to the other people, his friends. He said, "I've got a right one here." So I joined him, and I bought his swan-necked hoe. And that was quite a lot. That was 38p. It was, it actually, he'd lost the metal bit at the end. And it was just the hand. But I'm sure my wife will appreciate that it's an incomplete swan-necked hoe with a swan-necked hoe. So I've got these items for my wife. So next Saturday, I'm not worried, and I'm not singing to myself, "Oh dear, what can the matter be?" Because I've got the items. So I'll sing to a different tune, actually the same tune, but different words. I'm now singing, looking forward to next Saturday. Here's what I've got you, my dear. "Ho, dear, what can the matter be?"
Also, something similar.
Something very similar.
Well, damn, Frank, confirm my worst suspicions about car boot sales. Dennis, let's see how you get on with every little movement has a meaning of its own.
I had another twinge of my old trouble the other day. I picked up a newspaper and was immediately confronted by a headline that said, "Public borrowing down." And I found myself wondering, why on earth would members of the public want to borrow down? Could it be because so many of them are now going in for duvets? And if that is the case, and it's expensive, this is why they're borrowing it, could we get to a position where down is up? And that feeling of vague confusion became even worse when on the arts page I came across an article that was headed, "Picasso draws large crowds." I suppose it's changed from doing individual portraits. But as any regular listener will have immediately diagnosed, I'd once again come down with the unfortunate mental affliction known as literalism. That worrying condition whose main symptom is an incurable tendency to take words and phrases at their face value. So if, for example, you see an advertisement for a stick deodorant, you immediately start wondering how many people suffer from smelly sticks. Or if someone happens to ask if you know a little woman who could run up some curtains for them. Well, your first reaction is work out just how little such a woman would need to be. However, the good news that I bring victims of this worrying disability today is that all sorts of organisations are now being formed to fight it. There's WAL, for instance, Women Against Literalism, because all of their members have known the pure hell of living with a man who only ever responds to the literal meaning of everyday phrases. They quote, for example, the husband who suffered major injury by obeying one of his wife's instructions to the letter. It occurred in a restaurant when she said, "Don't turn round, but look who's just come in behind." His collar blown. And among other case histories that are cited by members of the WAL, or Wallies, as they're... there's several examples of one tragic side effect of literalism, sometimes referred to as the "you didn't say" syndrome, as in, "Did you look in the oven to see if the casserole's all right?" "Yes, I looked in the oven." "Is it all right?" "No, it's burning." "Did you take it out?" "No." "Why not?" "You didn't say." But besides WAL, there's also JAL, Journalists Against Literalism. Now, this is a group pledged to rid the British press of such bewildering headlines as the one that recently announced the entry of one of our leading record companies into the airline business, Virgin Expands. CSAL represents concerned civil servants dedicated to eradicating confusing public notices. You see, life's hard enough for us literalism sufferers without shops suddenly confronting us with a sign that says, "These premises are alarmed." or even, as hit me when I was in a resort on the South Coast recently, a notice that announced shrimp teas, an expression which, to the literal-minded, can only mean something like plankton or algae, you know, or whatever it is that shrimps have for tea. And what's equally welcome is the news that even the chairman of this program, the respected Michael O'Donnell, has now joined the ranks of DAL, or Doctors Against Literalism. Now, admittedly, they still haven't managed to get literalism classified as one of the things you can claim for on Bupa, but at least they've now promised that as a profession, they'll try to avoid such ambiguities as drink lots of fluids, as though there was anything else. Drink biscuits, you know. And they'll also try to spare us literalists the kind of heart-stopping moment that I got recently when I read what was written on a bottle of pills I'd been prescribed. Take one before going to bed, it said, which was easy enough. But then it went on, and another one if you wake up. So, fellow literalists, the good news is that any kind of phrase capable of misinterpretation is now getting the protection of a special interest group specifically recruited to take care of it, or to put that news in a rather more musical form, every literal meaning has a movement of its own.
Thank you very much, Dennis. Well, I see from the score sheet that Antonia and Dennis have won this week's Star Prize, which is a romantic trip for two to the Paris studio in the heart of London to compete against Dillis and Frank in our next programme. And until then, goodbye.
In My Word, Michael O'Donnell was in the chair. The questions were compiled by Peter Moore, and the programme was produced for the BBC by Tony Shrine and Pete Atkins.